My name is Alex Nielsen. I'm at the System Science Graduate Program at Portland State University, and my talk today is Simulating Health Policy Interventions to Reduce Non-Medical Use of Pharmaceutical Opioids. And we have no financial or non-financial relationships to disclose. On the earlier slide, it said we did, but that's actually greater than the 12-month period that we have to disclose for. This is our research team, our principal investigators, Wayne Wakeland, who is a simulation and modeling expert, and then Dennis McCarty, who's in public health. We have a great research team and expert panel members on pain and prescription drug abuse. And we'd like to thank NIDA for funding this work. So this is the general flow of what I'm going to be speaking on. So many of you in this room are well aware of the current national trends in non-medical use of opioids, but I'll review them here briefly. Non-medical use of prescription opioids has been recognized as a growing public health problem, and initiation of opioid use saw a dramatic increase in the 1990s and early 2000s. So in the past 15 years, non-medical use has stabilized at a high level, which means that the problem is now endemic. So these numbers are in thousands, and they've stabilized between 4 and 5% of the population over 12 years old. So poisoning deaths have likewise been on a sharp upward trajectory. Accidental poisonings of all types now exceed car accidents as the leading cause of accidental death in the United States. So as was discussed in the plenary session yesterday by Dr. Clark of SAMHSA, there seems to be a culture of hoarding and sharing prescription drugs. So 55% of opioids used non-medically were obtained free from a friend or relative, and close to 80% of the time, the source of those drugs was one doctor. So Dr. Clark also went on to show that people who use higher amounts tend to use alternative sources. So this suggests that people initiating non-medical use and people who use at low levels are using out of the medicine cabinet. So the medicine cabinet. At national take-back days, you know, tons of medicines are collected. It isn't feasible to separate out the opioids from all the other medicines that come in to get a sense of what those quantities really are. But a research group in Madison, Wisconsin, found that at one of their take-back days, the DEA collected about 100,000 opioid dosage units. So that's from people who wanted to and took the time to properly dispose of their medicines. So we know from how much people throw away that there's a lot of unused medicine out there. So small studies have also been done on how much medicine goes into this latent medicine cabinet supply. So one urology practice in Utah conducted a study on post-surgical patients and found that 67% of those patients have leftover opioids, and 91% of that medicine is kept in the home. So we know that we have a problem with non-medical use, and we know that there's a lot of unused medicine out there being shared. So my team has been working on developing a systems-level model of non-medical use in the United States. And we use the system dynamics modeling method. We're presenting the initiation sector today, of our model today. So system dynamics is a modeling method that uses systems of simultaneous differential equations to simulate system behavior over time. The approach provides a framework with which to capture underlying processes and feedback loops that generate behavior in a system. So when applied to public health problems, system dynamics modeling allows for the simulation of intervention alternatives in order to provide policymakers with tools to assess interventions for magnitude of impact and potential for unintended consequences. So information that is not available from research focused on individual aspects of a system. So in this model, there are three principal feedback processes shown at this simplified high level. People initiate non-medical use when they're introduced to the idea by friends. And that's the green infection loop. And people who want to get opioids for free open up the leftover supply held by friends and family. So you can imagine that there are opioids, leftover opioids out there that are never going to be accessed for non-medical use. They're just stored away somewhere and nobody can actually get at them. But here, some of the opioids do become available for non-medical use as people seek them out. And that's the purple or blue loops here. And then people who develop use disorders eventually outstrip their local free supply and transition to paying for opioids, and that's here in orange. So before I take a deeper look at the model, I'm going to be a champion for systems-level models. So systems-level models can give us a coarse-grained view of broad trends, while empirical studies often give a fine-grained view of local conditions and trends, which is very important. So systems models are powerful because they can blend qualitative understanding of what is happening using the causal map and feedback structure with quantitative empirical data. So you can and you must integrate data from multiple sources to make these models work. And it also reveals where data are absent. So you can find high leverage intervention points and reveal downstream effects, both main effects and side effects. And the visual representation of the chains of causality can encourage communication and the sharing of ideas and stories. So we start with the initiation loop. So we model initiation as the spread of an infection. So we assume that susceptible individuals consist of people who are exposed to opioids via prescribing for acute pain, as well as youth who perceive little risk in opioid use. Susceptible individuals and recreational users here in red come into contact socially, and some of these interactions result in the transmission of the idea to use opioids non-medically. So this combined with access to opioids results in initiation of non-medical use. So as the number of infected recreational users increases, there's more opportunity for contact, initiation increases, resulting in a positive feedback loop. So after initiation, people transition through different stages of drug use in our model. At first, people use what they can get for free. Some users quit, and then some of them develop a use disorder here. At first, these people who with use disorders still use what they can get for free, but then at some point, they can't sustain high levels of use with what they can get for free and then transition into payment. So this is a little more granular look at the dynamics of supply and demand, which modifies the progression of people through this drug use trajectory. So we're going to take a look at global availability dynamics, which is the purple loops first, and then personal accessibility. So users who want free opioids open up supply by seeking medicines from people in their social networks. So some fraction of prescription holders asked have leftovers and are willing to share them. So these leftovers become available for use by these free users, and they enter what we call the medicine cabinet here. So prescription holders only need to know one person seeking free opioids for these opioids to be available. So if 10% of the population, say, is seeking free opioids and people have around 40 people in their social networks, the likelihood that a prescription holder knows someone who's looking for opioids can be about 80%. So this is really highly nonlinear. So first, as users open up supply, this increases the ratio of supply and demand, which increases initiation and decreases quitting among recreational users. This is a positive feedback loop. So as we go around this loop, populations and the pill stocks both grow. However, the same people who are opening up this supply are also consuming out of this supply. So this tends to decrease the ratio of supply over demand, and this is a balancing feedback loop. So as you get more users, you have a decrease in the pill stock and resulting in fewer users. And then also, the denominator of the supply-demand ratio also rises when there are more free users, so which leads to less initiation and more quitting. So this is another balancing feedback process. So now we move on to the personal accessibility loop. Individuals who with use disorder can only access the free medicine of the people in their own personal social networks, who are willing to share. So this is the small wedge of the pill pie here. So as they need larger amounts of opioids to support their addictions, they're going to exhaust their local pill supply faster and have to transition to paying for opioids because they can't get it for free anymore. In another sector of this model, we explore the dynamics of supply and demand from non-free sources and also explore possible transition into heroin use. So strong empirical support is being sought for the large number of model parameters. We've identified the empirical support for the following parameters and have arrived at plausible values for other parameters through model calibration. So at this stage, the model is exploratory, but even exploratory models need to be validated before they can be useful. So we calibrated the model to fit three time series from the NSDUH from 1995 to 2005, and then we used them to predict 2006 to 2011. So here RBP is reference behavior pattern or the time series of the data. So the model is the dashed line and the solid line is data from NSDUH. So the model fits the data fairly well with a mean absolute percent error of 6.8%. Here, the model fits the data fairly well in the later part of the time series, though not well in the earlier part of the time series, with a mean absolute percent error in 2006 to 2011 of 4.2%. And then here, this is comparing people with use disorder model and data, and the fit is actually fairly good as well at 6.2%. Mean absolute percent error. So once we validated, we moved on to exploring some leverage points for how effective interventions could be. So these strategies were implemented as parameter changes in 2005. So we say, what if the DEA is able to change their regulations so that people can return their prescription drugs to a pharmacy. So we say, well, let's model that as a 25% reduction in the amount of leftovers that people have. And then take back days, what if we say take back days are consistently effective and can remove 100 million dosage units per year across from the medicine cabinet. And then the hydrocodone reschedule, doctors are known to be more reluctant to prescribe Schedule 2 medications than Schedule 3, so we just modeled this as a simple 25% reduction in people receiving opioids for acute pain, period. So I'll go very quickly through results. We found that the supply-side strategies have a large impact on the simulated number of non-medical users. The magnitudes of the effects are really similar because structurally these interventions are quite similar. Reducing supply increases quitting, decreases initiation, and pushes heavy users to other sources. So we have demand-side strategies as well. So we have a parametric change in 2005, infectivity, 25% reduction in the virulence of the opioid use idea. Perception of harm, a 25% reduction in the number of youths who see little risk in opioid use. So that is changing the size of the susceptible pool and could be seen as like an inoculation. And then the reschedule is kind of a quasi-demand side, so fewer people are exposed to opioids through their own prescriptions. So reducing the perception of harm reduces the number of users, but slowly because it's an indirect effect. on initiation. The infectivity intervention decreases non-medical users sharply at first, but then, as you can see in the green, it recovers. So the effect is overwhelmed as reducing users decreases the demand denominator and the supply-demand ratio more than it decreases the supply opened up by drug seeking, so because of the non-linearity in the likelihood function. The reschedule has the greatest impact because it reduces both the susceptible population and the opioid supply. So we were surprised by the considerable leverage of supply-side interventions. We were actually expecting demand-side interventions to be stronger. Limiting supply reduced the number of casual users, but it pushed those who are already addicted to riskier supply sources. And one thing that I don't have here, but is quite important, the difference between reducing the number of leftovers by 25% and reducing the number of people who can have access to opioids by 25% is actually not, there is no difference in our model on how many non-medical users you get. So one of them has an unintended consequence of the non-treatment of pain, and the other one doesn't. So this is an interesting opportunity. So limitations, we need stronger empirical support, and it needs to be simplified. And we're using the NSDUH, which has known issues with missing hidden populations. Future research, we're also adding outcomes and investigating balloon effects, transition into heroin. We need to strengthen the face validity of this model by reaching out to the population of concern. So we're modeling populations of people who use drugs, prescription drugs non-medically, and it's best to reach out to this population to see if our assumptions that are built into this model really speak to their experience. And it would be best to have interventions that can be analyzed in terms of inputs just instead of just in terms of parametric changes. So inputs like money and manpower and not just outputs like we assume that it's going to be this effective. Okay, if you want the full model or you have questions, please contact me or RPI, Dr. Wayne Wakeland.